Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. On tonight's program, A Life in Poetry, An Evening with Jeffrey Hill, faculty members gather to celebrate the career of the renowned poet, author, and teacher. The event is sponsored by the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts, the University Professors Program, and the Hillel at Boston University. We begin with an introduction by Luce Program Director Peter Hawkins.
On behalf of the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts, the University Professors Program, and Hillel, it's my pleasure to welcome you this evening to a celebration of Jeffrey Hill's 18 years as a teacher and colleague at Boston University. Our celebration, of course, has to take note of his accomplishments as a writer, of prose, as well as of poetry, the poetry that's made him famous. There are 3 books of prose, 15 books of poetry, a body of work for which he's been recognized by prestigious awards and lectureships. Perhaps it's enough, however, to quote John Hollander of Yale, who is, like Jeffrey Hill, both a poet and a scholar. Quote, "I feel him to be without question the major English poet of his generation, indeed of several preceding ones, and in an English tradition of imaginative power, seen before him in Hardy and D.H. Lawrence." But whereas any group of intelligent people could gather together to celebrate Jeffrey Hill the writer, we at Boston University are privileged to have known him in other ways, as a reader, as a colleague, and as a teacher. True, his teaching career started off at the universities of Leeds and Cambridge, but it has flowered right here. As a university professor, he's done his fair share of introductory and comparative courses for that program, as well as overseen countless directed studies. In addition, there have been seminars that have, in effect, shaped a generation of BU students. Literature and Religion in England, Poetry and Religion, English Poetry and World War I, Voice and Otherness, taught with Lucien Richard, and Jared Manley Hopkins. Students, of course, know their teachers in ways that colleagues never know one another. They get to see what animates our careers and what gets our dander up. They receive what we have to give, which is infinitely more than what's shared between us at departmental meetings and, let's face it, on the run. For this reason, I want to share with you something of what Jeffrey Hill students think of him. I wish I could say this is a random sample I'm about to give you, but it's not. I wish I could say that I had drawn from the English department, the writing program, the university professors, the editorial institute, but I haven't. I've drawn on graduate students who are my advisees in the Religion and Literature doctoral program, which now is sadly reduced because of Jeffrey's retirement. Here goes. The students in Professor Hill's Hopkins seminar frequently heard him casually knock the weekly poetry offerings in The New Yorker. When he wanted to make mention of bad verse, The New Yorker was shorthand. Several members of the class were creative writing graduates, people who no doubt were trying dearly to land their work in the very pages to which, according to Professor Hill, stood for all that is wrong with contemporary poetry. So one week, one of those students brought a current copy of The New Yorker to class and respectfully, but with a huge grin, asked Professor Hill to show us what he meant about the magazine's bad poetry. What I remember most about this is that Professor Hill did not even flinch. He grabbed the magazine, flipped open to the first poem he could find, and read it aloud, verse by verse, pausing at every line break to offer a trenchant, hilarious commentary. He ripped the thing to shreds, and it was a great fun to listen to him do it. But he was never rude and never mean. It was as if he was trying to save poetry. And if there had to be a few casualties along the way, so be it. Another. Jeffrey Hill urged us to think of poetry as witness rather than pleasure. It is the existence of poetry, not its appeal to us, which matters. This, as Jesus' disciples used to say, is a hard saying. Regardless of the relationship between pleasure and poetry, the opportunity to study with Geoffrey Hill was one of the great pleasures of my academic career. I now have an ongoing relationship with poems I previously knew only in passing. And then finally, together with that one. Also, it should be said that he returned each set of papers for both classes last semester in less than a week, without in any way sacrificing thoroughness. There was correction tape on my essay, where he had reconsidered some of his comments and later amended them. He also caught a typo at the end of my bibliography. This is surely some sort of academic record on either side of the Atlantic. And then the third and last of these appreciations. Taking one of Professor Hill's courses is like ingesting a potent psychoactive substance. And taking three of his courses effected a permanent change in the way I think. I hope to have startling flashbacks for the rest of my life. The way he puts words and ideas together stimulated my neurons to start firing in unaccustomed, exhilarating directions. Professor Hill teaches by example how to read at a very high level, looking both at a panoramic view of a writer's historical situation and through a magnifying glass at word choice and syntax. He succeeds in demonstrating how details such as verse form, manuscript revisions, marginalia, linguistic slippages, or typographical style are intimately interrelated with matters of life and death, sex, cultural survival, salvation, and damnation. Professor Hill is also a master of one-liners, both humorous and edifying, and often both at once. Here is a tiny selection. Our timeless truths begin around 1760, 1770. Poetry is wilder than the wildest bronco. It is our human nature that we will all misread one another. And in an advisory side, during a class discussion of poetry's lack of political clout, he said, just cling to the idea that we live in a fallen world. If we can persuade ourselves of that, then we can be reasonably happy. The student ends, I rejoice that Professor Hill, despite his years on this side of the Atlantic, has maintained a thoroughly British sense of irony. I'm grateful that I learned from him about the importance in one's own efforts of developing the diligence necessary to relate to the otherness of other people and the otherness of language. And not only that, but to remember, even amidst such efforts, that it is a matter of great seriousness not to take oneself too seriously. It occurred to Bruce Redford and me when planning this event that perhaps the best way to showcase Geoffrey Hill as a teacher would be to have him to read to us. Read to us from texts that he has taught over these last 18 years, texts that have become so memorable to his students precisely because of the intelligence, care, and passion he brings to our language. The first part of the program, therefore, will be Geoffrey Hill reading some of the texts he's been working with during these years at BU. But we also wanted to include some of his own poems this evening, and to that end, I asked him to choose a few readers who he would trust with his writing. Each of us has chosen a poem to read, which we offer with thanks, with affection, and with respect. But first, Geoffrey Hill.
Thank you so very much. Let me begin by reading the concluding lines of Psalm 90. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Return, O Lord, how long? And let it repent thee concerning thy servants. O satisfy us early with thy mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days wherein thou hast afflicted us, and the years wherein we have seen evil. Let thy work appear unto thy servants, and thy glory unto their children. And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands, establish thou it. I will read now a short poem by the Tudor poet Thomas Wyatt, called They Flee From Me That Sometime Did Me Seek. They flee from me that sometime did me seek, with naked foot stalking in my chamber. I have seen them, gentle, tame, and meek, that now are wild, and do not remember that sometime they put themselves in danger to take bread at my hand, and now they range, busily seeking with a continual change. Thanked be fortune, it hath been otherwise 20 times better, but once in special, in thin array after a pleasant guise, when her loose gown from her shoulders did fall, and she me caught in her arms long and small, therewithal sweetly did me kiss, and softly said, Dear heart, how like you this? It was no dream, I lay broad waking, but all is turned thorough my gentleness into a strange fashion of forsaking, and I have leave to go of her goodness, and she also to use new fangledness. But since that I so kindly am served, I would fain know what she hath deserved. I would like to follow this with Shakespeare's 66th sonnet. I believe that Pasternak translated this, and at the readings that he gave, there was always the cry, if he had failed to do so, give us the 66th, someone would shout from the audience, give us the 66th, and I will give you the 66th. Tired with all these, for restful death I cry, as to behold desert a beggar born, and needy nothing trimmed in jollity, and purest faith unhappily forsworn, and gilded honour shamefully misplaced, and maiden virtue rudely strumpeted, and right perfection wrongfully disgraced, and strength by limping sway disabled, and art made tongue-tied by authority, and folly doctor-like controlling skill, and simple truth miscalled simplicity, and captive good attending captain ill. Tired with all these, from these would I be gone, save that to die, I leave my love alone. A very difficult poem now to read. It's by John Donne, and it's called A Nocturnal Upon St. Luce's Day, being the shortest day. 'Tis the year's midnight, and it is the day's Luce's, who scarce 7 hours herself unmasks. The sun is spent, and now his flasks send forth light squibs, no constant rays. The world's whole sap is sunk. The general balm the hydroptic earth hath drunk, whither, as to the bed's feet, life is shrunk, dead and interred. Yet all these seem to laugh compared with me, who am their epitaph. Study me then, you who shall lovers be at the next world, that is, of the next spring. For I am every dead thing in whom love wrought new alchemy. For his art did express a quintessence even from nothingness, from dull privation and lean emptiness. He ruined me, and I am rebegot of absence, darkness, death, things which are not. All others from all things draw all that's good, life, soul, form, spirit, whence they being have. I, by love's limbeck, am the grave of all that's nothing. Oft a flood of we two wept, and so drowned the whole world, us two. Oft did we grow to be two chaoses, when we did show care to aught else, and often absences withdrew our souls and made us carcasses. But I am by her death, which word wrongs her, of the first nothing the elixir grown. Were I a man, that I were one, I needs must know. I should prefer if I were any beast, some ends, some means. Yea, plants, yea, stones detest and love. All some properties invest. If I an ordinary nothing were, a shadow, a light and body must be here. But I am none, nor will my sun renew. You lovers, for whose sake the lesser sun at this time to the goat is run to fetch new lust and give it you, enjoy your summer all. Since she enjoys her long night's festival, let me prepare towards her, and let me call this hour her vigil and her eve, since this, both the years and the days, deep midnight is. A jump now to the Romantics, to the beautiful passage from Wordsworth's description of crossing the Alps, taken from the 1805 version. The dull and heavy slackening that ensued upon these tidings by the peasant given was soon dislodged. Downwards we hurried fast and entered with the road which we had missed into a narrow chasm. The brook and road were fellow travellers in this gloomy pass, and with them did we journey several hours at a slow step. The immeasurable height of woods decaying, never to be decayed, the stationary blasts of waterfalls, and everywhere along the hollow rent, winds thwarting winds, bewildered and forlorn, the torrents shooting from the clear blue sky, the rocks that muttered close upon our ears, black drizzling crags that spake by the wayside, as if a voice were in them, the sick sight and giddy prospect of the raving stream, the unfettered clouds and region of the heavens, tumult and peace, the darkness and the light, were all like workings of one mind, the features of the same face, blossoms upon one tree, characters of the great apocalypse, the types and symbols of eternity, of first and last, and midst, and without end. Now one of Walt Whitman's most beautiful poems, short poem called Beginners. How they are provided for upon the earth, appearing at intervals. How dear and dreadful they are to the earth, how they inure to themselves as much as to any. What a paradox appears their age, how people respond to them, yet know them not, how there is something relentless in their fate all times, how all times mischoose the objects of their adulation and reward, and how the same inexorable price must still be paid for the same great purchase. I'm going to attempt to read a poem by Gerard Hopkins. It would seem absurd, particularly after the very, very generous introduction that has been given to this reading. It would seem to be absurd to leave Hopkins out. Unfortunately, I chose one of the very most difficult of all his poems to read, and I am not confident tonight in my capacity to meet its demands. However, I will make an effort. It's The Leaden Echo and the Golden Echo. How to keep, is there any? Is there none such, nowhere known some? Bow or brooch or braid or brace, lace, latch or catch or key, to keep back beauty, keep it, beauty, 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 from vanishing away. Oh, is there no frowning of these wrinkles, ranked wrinkles deep down? No waving off of these most mournful messengers, still messengers, sad and stealing messengers of grey? No, there's none, there's none. Oh, no, there's none. Nor can you long be what you now are, called fair. Do what you may do, what, do what you may. And wisdom is early to despair. Be beginning, since no, nothing can be done, to keep at bay age and age's evils, hoar hair, ruck and wrinkle, drooping, dying, death's worst, winding sheets, tombs and worms, and tumbling to decay. So be beginning to be beginning to despair. Oh, there's none. No, 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 there's none. Be beginning to despair, to despair, 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 spare. There is one. Yes, I have one. Hush there. Only not within seeing of the sun, not within the singeing of the strong sun, tall suns tinging or treacherous, the tainting of the earth's air. Somewhere elsewhere there is, ah, well, where? One. One. Yes, I can tell such a key. I do know such a place, where whatever's prized and passes of us, everything that's fresh and fast flying of us, seems to us sweet of us, and swiftly away with, done away with, undone, undone, done with, soon done with, and yet dearly and dangerously sweet of us, the wimpled, water dimpled, not by morning matched face, the flower of beauty, fleece of beauty, too apt to, ah, to fleet. Never fleets more, fastened with the tenderest truth to its own best being and its loveliness of youth. It is an everlastingness of, oh, it is an all youth. Come then your ways and airs and looks, locks, maiden gear, gallantry and gaiety and grace. Winning ways, airs innocent, maiden manners, sweet looks, loose locks, long locks, love locks, gay gear, going gallant, girl grace. Resign them, sign them, seal them, send them. Motion them with breath, and with sighs soaring, soaring sighs, deliver them. Beauty in the ghost, deliver it early now. Long before death, give beauty back. Beauty, beauty, beauty. Back to God, beauty's self and beauty's giver. See, not a hair is, not an eyelash, not the least lash lost. Every hair is hair of the head numbered. Nay, what we had light-handed left in surly the mere mould would have waked and have waxed and have walked with the wind what while we slept. This side, that side, hurling a heavy-headed hundredfold, what while we slumbered. Oh, then, weary then, why should we tread? Oh, why are we so haggard at the heart, so care-coiled, care-killed, so fagged, so fashed, so cogged, so cumbered, when the thing we freely forfeit is kept with fonder a care kept than we could have kept it, kept far with fonder a care, and we should have lost it. Finer, fonder a care kept. Where kept? Do but tell us where kept. Where? Yonder? What, high as that? We follow. Now we follow. Yonder? Yes, yonder. 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 A poem by the young, as he was then, Jewish poet, British Jewish poet Isaac Rosenberg, one of the most severe losses to poetry of the First World War. Isaac Rosenberg's expression: call, call and bruise the air, shatter dumb space. Yea, we will fling this passion everywhere, leaving no place for the superb and grave, magnificent throng, the pregnant queens of quietness that brave and edge our song of wonder at the light, our life leased home, of greeting to our housemates. And in might our song shall roam life's heart, a blossoming fire blown bright by thought, while gleams and fades the infinite desire, phantasmed naught. Can this be caught and caged? Wings can be clipped of eagles, the sun's gaudy measure gauged, but no sense dipped in the mystery of sense. The troubled throng of words break out like smothered fire through dense and smouldering wrong. A short poem by Dylan Thomas called 24 Years. 24 years remind the tears of my eyes. Bury the dead for fear that they walk to the grave in labor. In the groin of the natural doorway I crouched like a tailor, sewing a shroud for a journey by the light of the meat-eating sun. Dressed to die, the sensual strut begun, with my red veins full of money, in the final direction of the elementary town, I advance for as long as forever is. My penultimate poem, the penultimate poem that I shall be reading, that is. I think my ultimate poem is already behind me. But one of my great favorites, a poem by D.H. Lawrence called Bavarian Gentians. Not every man has gentians in his house in soft September at slow, sad Michaelmas. Bavarian gentians, big and dark, only dark darkening the daytime torchlight with the smoking blueness of Pluto's gloom. Ribbed and torchlike, with their blaze of darkness spread blue down, flattening into points, flattened under the sweep of white day. Torch flower of the blue smoking darkness, Pluto's dark blue days, black lamps from the halls of Dis, burning dark blue, giving off darkness, blue darkness, as Demeter's pale lamps give off light. Lead me then, lead me the way. reach me a gentian, give me a torch, let me guide myself with the blue forked torch of this flower down the darker and darker stairs where blue is darkened on blueness, even where Persephone goes just now from the frosted September to the sightless realm where darkness is awake upon the dark, and Persephone herself is but a voice or a darkness invisible, enfolded in the deeper dark of the arms plutonic and pierced with the passion of dense gloom. Among the splendor of torches of darkness, shedding darkness on the lost bride and her groom. The ending of Psalm 39 in the English version, the beautiful, though often very inaccurate, English versions. Deliver me from all my transgressions, make me not the reproach of the foolish. I was dumb, I opened not my mouth, because thou didst it. Remove thy stroke away from me, I am consumed by the blow of thy hand. When thou with rebukes dost correct man for iniquity, thou makest his beauty to consume away like a moth. Hold not thy peace at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee, and a sojourner, as all my fathers were. O spare me a little, that I may recover my strength, before I go hence, and be no more seen. Thank you.
It's one thing to read anything after Geoffrey Hill. It's another thing to read Geoffrey Hill after Geoffrey Hill. I'm Peter Hawkins. I'm director of the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts. To Lucienne Richard, on suffering. The undulant road makes the way out tide rise and fall. After the merchant's houses, the tarred fishing shacks and places that sell bait. After the shade trees, the gleaned reaches of sand. Sea bass are plentiful. Although the smallest get thrown back, legal, they mostly die, float for a short while, scales catching the sun. Granite plugs through sand bluffs. The stub lighthouses resemble follies or summer houses for checkerboard painters. Gulls appear laggard, and yet they are sleekly primed. The fine machinery of instinctual natures is well adjusted to the environment, hooks up arrivals to the thermal tower. I take on, Seneca. Could have sung like Jonah, at your discretion. So enjoyed it when the weighted line you cast tore from its rod, bait and all, and flippered and was gone. The timing perfect, perfect your chagrin-charged resignation. Mute, expressive glare. No chance to practice custody of the eye. So I said to them, half-blinded, which of you is the angel? And which angel? I did not think there were angels. The sea light was visionary, as it sometimes is to susceptible people. Dead or alive, we sojourn in the world's refuge and abattoir. Pity about the tackle. I could have wept. John Wessling, President Emeritus of Boston University.
I'm sure I speak for all of the readers when I say that I feel in approaching reading Jeffrey Hill like Jeffrey Hill feels approaching reading Jared Manley Hopkins, only more so. I intend to read two poems. They are poems that are great exemplars of Jeffrey's attention to poetry as witness. The first is De Iure Belli Ac Pacis from his collection Canaan of 1996. The second, September Song from King Laud, 1968. The people moves as one spirit unfettered, claim our assessors of stone. When the nations fall dispossessed, such conjurings possess them. Elaborate barren fountains, projected aqueducts where water is no longer found. Where would one find Grotius, for that matter? The secular justice clamant among psalms, huge-fisted, visionary Comenius. Could none predict these haughty degradations, as now your high-strung, martyred resistance serves to consecrate the liberties of Maastricht? So der Erzengel Michael in Kampf gegen den Drachen, Michael den Engel der deutschen Geschichte. He saw the Archangel Michael in struggle against the dragon. Michael, the angel of German history. The iron-beamed engine shed has chapel windows. Glare-eyed you spun. The hooks are still on the beam. A sun patch drains to nothing. Here the chalked blade sluiced into place. Here the abused blood set its own wreaths. Time passes, strengthening and fading. Europa hetera displays her parts. Her triumph attacks even Dürer's resplendent economy in rictus and graven sorrow. On some envisioned rothouse clock, geared like a mill, the dragon strikes. The archangel, unseeing, unbowed, chimes with each stroke. You foretold us, hazarding the proscribed tongue of piety and shame, plain righteousness committed with much else to Christ's bees for their particular keeping. We might have kept your Christian inhibitions, faithful, non-jurant, in the singing court of dread, at the grid of extortion, but chose pity. This pity is shameless, unlike memory. Though both can draw sugar from iron, pity, alone with its rage, settles on multitudes as the phoenix sought from 100 cities tribute of requiting flame. In Plötzensee, where you were hanged, they now hang tokens of reparation, and in good faith compound with Cicero's maxims, Schiller's chant, your silenced witness. To the high-minded, base metal forgers of this common Europe, community of parody, you stand eccentric as a prophet. There is no better vision than I can summon. You were upheld on the strong wings of the Psalms before you died. evil is not good's absence, but gravity's everlasting bedrock and its fatal chains, inert, violent, the suffrage of our days. Not harmonies, harmonics, astral whisperings, light years above the stave, groans, murmurs, cries, tappings from cell to cell. It is a night watch, indeterminate and of vast concentration of those redeeming their pledged fear, who strike faith from the hard rock of God's fallenness. Their pain draws recompense beyond our grasp of recapitulation. Slurred clangor, cavernous and chained haltings, echo from time's inchoate music, the theme standing proclaimed only in the final measures. Vexilla Regis, uplifted by Rüdiger Schleicher's violin. Der Tod nahm über uns Gewalt, hielt uns in seinem Reich gefangen. Halleluja. Death seized us by force, held us prisoner in his Reich. Halleluja. Those three eternal days, Christus did not lie shackled in death, but found out your stark Reich. Deep buried hypocaust, dense for the harrowing. Held there since time so holds within itself, slow, precise, Felgiebel, chivalrous Hofacker, clamped in their silence, keeps also girdlers doubled many times consummated agony. In whatever fortress, on whatever foundation, then, now, in eternum, the spirit bears witness through its broken flesh to grace more enduring even than mortal corruption. Ineradicable, and rightly so. Smart whip, tap, at boot top. Absolute license of the demons to wreak their correction. Elsewhere, they are fixed self torches in sulfur, as there is a God elsewhere of jealous mercy. That is not news. The book of Daniel's strength, unwritten. Zion's resurgent lamentation in Chrysau's witnessing here undenizened to the sand, to the old waste. So let the rites be speculation, fantastic pickings, late gold of Europa in her brief modish rags. Schindler, Schindler. Hinrichtungsstätte war ein Schuppen in Gefängnis. The place of execution was a shed within the prison. But if, and if nowhere but here, archives for catacombs, letters, codes, prayers, film scraps, dossiers, shale of crunched shellac, new depths of invention, children's songs to mask torture. Christus, it is not your stable. It will serve as well as any other den or shippen the arraigned truth, the chorus with its gifts of humiliation, incense, and fumatory, Lucerna, the soul flame, as it has stood through such ages, ebbing and again lambent, replenished in its stoop of clay. and September Song, inscribed, born 19-6-32, deported 24-9-42. Undesirable, you may have been. Untouchable, you were not. Not forgotten or passed over at the proper time. As estimated, you died. Things marched sufficient to that end, just so much cyclone and leather, patented terror, so many routine cries. I have made an elegy for myself. It is true. September fattens on vines. Roses flake from the wall. The smoke of harmless fires drifts to my eyes. This is plenty. This is more than enough.
Christopher Ricks, the Editorial Institute.
To the Supposed Patron is the last poem in Geoffrey Hill's first book, For the Unfallen, or For the Unfallen. Prodigal of loves and barbecues, expert in the strangest faunas, at home he considers the lilies, the rewards. There is no substitute for a rich man. At his first entering a new province with new coin, music, the barest glancing of steel or gold suffices. There are many tremulous dreams secured under that head. For his delight and his capacity to absorb freshly the inside succulence of untoughened sacrifice, his bronze agents speculate among convertible stones and drink desert sand. That no mirage irritate his mild gaze, the lewd noonday is housed in cool places, and fountains salt the sparse haze. His flesh is made clean. For the unfallen, the firstborn, or wise counsellor, prepared vistas extend as far as harvest, and idyllic death, where fish at dawn ignite the powdery lake. The second poem I read at Geoffrey Hill's invitation, The Turtle Dove. Love that drained her, drained him she loved, though each for the other's sake forged passion upon speech, bore their close days through sufferance towards night, where she at length grasped sleep, and he lay quiet as though needing no questions now to guess what her secreting heart could not well hide. Her caught face flinched in half-sleep at his side. Yet she by day modelled her real distress, poised, turned her cheek to the attending world of children and intriguers and the old, conversed freely, exercised, was admired, being strong to dazzle. All this she endured to affront him. He watched her rough grief work under the formed surface of habit. She spoke like one long undeceived, but she was hurt. She denied more love, yet her starved eyes caught his, devouring, at times. Then, as one self-dared, she went to him, plied there, like a furious dove bore down with visitations of such love as his lithe, fathoming heart absorbed and buried.
Professor James Schmidt of the University Professors.
It occurred to me that the addressee of the first poem also made a journey from England to America and back to England. To William Cobbett in absentia, I say it is not faithless to stand without faith, keeping open vigil at the sight. Who shall endure? What force throws off the verdict of each day's idle and taunting honors? The lottery, the trade in grief, the outrageous quittance, the shiftless orders of fools. I say, let stand the entire deposed authority of vision just as it fell. Your righteous, unjust, and cordial angle, your singular pitch where labor is spoken of, your labor that brought to pass reborn commodity with uplifted hands, awed by its own predation. The second poem, also from Canaan, is that man, as a rational animal, desires the knowledge which is his perfection. Abiding provenance, I would have said the question stands. Even in adoration, clause upon clause, with or without assent, reason and desire on the same loop. I imagine singing, I imagine getting it right, the knowledge of sensuous intelligence entering into the work, spontaneous happiness as it was once given our sleeping nature to awake by and know innocence of first inscription.
Thanks and appreciation to Jeffrey Hill for being and being with us. Jeffrey Hill.
Loose Program in Scripture and Literary Arts Director Peter Hawkins closing tonight's program, A Life in Poetry, An Evening with Jeffrey Hill. Also speaking at tonight's celebration was Boston University President Emeritus John Wessling, Professor Christopher Ricks, Professor James Schmidt, and of course, Professor Jeffrey Hill. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.